Hey folks, it's Denise Howell here, and next up on our final episode of This Week in Law, Bob Ambrogi joins us. He is going to tell us his predictions for the year 2019 and everything important in the realm of legal technology. But in addition to that, we're going to look at Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez at dancing her way into our hearts with Listomania and remix culture. Who is Lawrence Lessig being name checked by? And oh my goodness, I think that Teslas are going to hover soon. All this and more on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Stefan Schweida, and Matt Curtis. Episode 448, recorded January 11th, 2019. Odious Buffoons. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for the finale of This Week in Law. This is our final episode of this show, which has run for 12 plus years. We are so excited that you are here with us to celebrate our wrapping up this show. We are thrilled to have been here with you doing the show for all this time. I personally am so thrilled, and I'm so amazed and excited to be here today with my co-hosts and a fabulous guest, per usual. Bob Ambrogi is joining us today. Bob is a podcaster in his own right and has the only had up until recently, the only podcast in the legal arena that was older and creakier and more ancient and hoary than this particular one that we're listening to right now.
Which could describe me as well, but yeah.
Bob's show, Lawyer to Lawyer, with my friend here in Orange County, California, J. Craig Williams, that he did for years and years, 13 years exactly, is still going strong with Craig. But you bidded a fond farewell a while ago, Bob, as we are bidding a fond farewell to TWiL today.
I did. I did it and decided I wanted to start my own podcast. I started one called Law Next, on focusing on innovation and entrepreneurship and law. And, you know, way back 13 years ago, Denise, when I started doing Lawyer to Lawyer, you were my inspiration. So you were podcasting well before I was.
That's so wonderful. Thank you so much for that. And I've loved your show, and I love Law Next as well, for folks who are interested in the latest and greatest developments of technology for the legal field. Bob Ambrogi is your man. Follow him. Be devoted to his podcast because he's going to keep you informed. Also here today are my two wonderful co-hosts to close out the show today. Stefan Schweida from the Dorsey firm in Seattle, Washington is here. Hi, Stefan.
Hi, Denise. Hi, Bob. Great to be here. Sad it's for the last time. It's kind of, you know, this new thing for me, and it's just being, you know, the celebrity status I've earned is being pulled out from under me, and I feel deprived already. I don't know what I'm going to do with my time now.
Well, you might have some summary judgment motions to work on or something like that, but we're thrilled that you've been here for the time that you have. It's been so wonderful getting to know you, and I promise that we are not yanking the show out from under you because of various Bolshevik references and content. This is not a modern form of McCarthyism. Just decided to go out on a high note, and yeah, so
just what a McCarthyist would say.
Yeah, exactly. It's precisely what a McCarthyist would say. Matt Curtis is here as well. Hello, Matt. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well. And I hope that now that we're closing, we can get Stefan's email going so he can get all those fan letters he's been missing.
Yeah, no, we're just not going to do the email at this point. You can continue to send Stefan email at his work email or at me. I don't know. If you keep sending mail to TWiL at twit.tv, will it still getting to me? Will it still get to me? I think so. So, you know, if you have like ongoing things that you want to submit and talk about and discuss about TWiL, TWiL at twit.tv should still work. Info at twit.tv will still work. Denise at twit.tv will still work for sure, because I'm going to keep on keeping on with Twit. And in fact, if you're looking for Twill next Friday, the 18th of January, I'm going to be hosting Triangulation, which is one of the things I'm going to be doing with the network going forward, is being one of the amazing co-hosts of Triangulation. I am awed to be in this company, and also popping up more frequently, one would hope, on Twit this week in tech. So that those are my game plans with the Twit Network going forward. But going forward today, we have quite a jam-packed show. I tried to make sure to put in, over the years, gosh, we've had so many amazing contributors to This Week in Law over the years, not only my wonderful co-hosts throughout the years, but the interns who have worked with us over the years. And one of them, Sani Doe, created some incredible bumpers. Franklin Graves created more. So I'm trying to showcase all of those today by getting through various topics that we covered. We never did make a space law bumper. Our space law segments tended to be either a part of a show or overtake the entire show. So I'm afraid we have no space law today, but we're trying to cover a lot of the other things that we generally cover. And so let's jump right into our copyright segment for the day. So I found in prepping this final episode of This Week in Law that there's a lot of continuity for what we've been doing over the last 12 years. And one of those things that is very current this week and yet harkens back to something that we've covered in the past is the video that came out for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, newly elected congressperson. Has just taken her seat. And of course, you have probably seen the video that was released of her when she was in college. I believe it was at Boston University, dancing away, doing one of the many Lizdomania remixes that was released a few years ago when I believe the first group that did it was someone in, you know, as I've looked back at the history of this, admittedly, a hipster in Brooklyn decided to do the first remix of the Breakfast Club dance scene to the tune of Lizdomania. And then many, many followed, including the one that featured our now current newly elected congressperson. And this has been much in the news in the last week or so, because at first it was released as a way to, I guess, discredit the fact that a congressperson would be cool enough to dance and be involved in such a thing. That backfired, obviously. And then we went on to consider, and folks at Above the Law went on to consider, the copyright ramifications of the whole thing. Because, of course, there was a lot of copyright discussion about these videos when they were made. And in fact, Professor Lawrence Lessig, in Highlighting Remix Culture, incorporated a bunch of these videos into a talk that he was giving that then got posted to YouTube and then got taken down by the rights holders of the music. And, of course, Lessig being Lessig did not just let that go and pushed back and actually managed to prevail on that and get the video reinstated under the DMCA. And I believe actually recovered money that you can when there's a wrongful takedown notice and you have to fight about that. So it's interesting that we have an incoming congressperson who is able to remind us that remix culture existed then and still exists. Matt, do you have any thoughts about this?
Yeah, you know, I thought it was just a great video. I didn't know that one of the many reasons I would never become a congressman because I couldn't dance, do that dance. But nonetheless, in terms of the copyright analysis, I think that, you just kind of hope that even if there is infringement here, that no one sues over it. It'll be interesting as we go forward, moving into generations where all of our childhoods were documented, seeing congressmen come up, I'm sure that this will be one of the least revealing issues that come up for our members of our body politic moving forward.
Let's hope so. You know, let's hope we can all just have a good dance about it and not worry about their policy and their politics. Stefan, any thoughts?
Yeah, it's funny. Remix culture to me is one of those concepts that is inherently much more interesting when it's not tied to copyright law. As soon as, some law professor tries to bask in the glow of the cool of remix culture by talking about copyright law, it immediately just makes it's just such a drag on the whole thing. I mean, you can imagine some clever beatboxer, hip hop dancer, just sort of doing something really cool and creative, and then just like turntable scratch, music stops, everybody turns lights on and goes home because Lawrence Lessig has decided this is an opportune moment to piggyback on that with a brief lecture nobody cares about. So,
My God,
just leave these poor people alone and let them have fun and don't bore them with the copyright implications. Who cares?
Yes, I was going to say even when it's Lessig, but apparently even when it's Lessig. Bob, anything you want to add?
I think Trump should hold firm on the government shutdown until every member of Congress films a dancing video.
Oh, I'm so behind that. And in particular, a Listomania Breakfast Club tribute kind of video. Exactly. I'm all for it. Speaking of remix culture, one of the things we were discussing before the holiday break, hope you all had a very happy holidays and happy new year, by the way, was the fact that as of January 1st, 2019, which was 10 days ago, the works from 1923 in the United States that could enter the public domain did, and tens of thousands of them did. And I just wanted to highlight the fact that, again, getting, sort of holiday religious on you all, a version of the Ten Commandments is one of those tens of thousands of works. The 1923 Cecil B. DeMille version of the Ten Commandments is now in the public domain. So if you should need this for anything that you're working on or referencing, it is there for you. And you should, check in with Creative Commons and just be aware of the fact that for the first time since the year 1976, we have had a year's worth of works under U.S. copyright enter the public domain, and it's kind of a big deal. And then that will continue going forward unless Congress decides that it won't. Stefan, any thoughts?
I haven't dug deep on what's actually entered the public domain. This is an opportunity actually where remix culture is a little bit interesting, because rather than talking about in generalities about large pronouncements about remix culture and what it means for copyright law, someone could actually just gain access to this and actually do the remixing and do something interesting. So I hope someone with more time on their hands goes in, finds some cool stuff, and puts together a sort of patchwork of memes and movies that are all spliced together based on this. And then I hope no copyright law professor sullies the experience with a lecture about what just happened. Just let them do the creative thing and then don't comment on it.
It's not going to happen. Yeah. We're all going to comment on it.
Yeah.
What we do.
Part of the job description.
Yeah.
It is. Matt, anything else to add?
Just a perpetual reminder that it's insane that, we're celebrating this, that something that happened 96 years ago is finally able to enter the remix culture. And that seems like a good thing, but that's a very long time to have rights protected. And I'm pretty sure no one in 1923 thought their rights were going to last that long or needed that for an inducement to make the work that they made.
Absolutely. Bob, anything you're planning to remix?
Well, one of the one of the authors that went into the public domain is E.E. Cummings. And probably the best comment that I saw about this item in the news was a tweet by an editor somewhere who said that he was thrilled that E.E. Cummings was finally going into the public domain so that he could correct all his punctuation and capitalization errors.
It's a lot of work.
Again, just like the law professor's not going to stop commenting, E.E. Cummings perpetually exists in lowercase and should. I feel like E.E. Cummings prefaced the entire 1990s and 2000s because that's when we stopped capitalizing things, right?
Right.
Okay, so moving on to some musical and entertainment related stories.
Just a little behind the scenes on that bumper. I always have to pause before that bumper because the audio level is really loud on it. So I have to reach over and turn it down before I play it. So
we don't mind loud applause here at This Week in Law at all. So one of the stories that was sent to us by one of our listeners, one of our longtime listeners, I have to thank Jonathan Annette for all of his contributions to the show, sent me a link to this story. And I love it because I absolutely adore Jonathan Colton. He's a longtime fan favorite and employee/host favorite of the TWiT network. He has a new project going on that definitely deserves our attention, at least briefly on this last episode of This Week in Law. He is making a cover album. It is called Some Guys, which of course references Some Girls by the Rolling Stones. And the reference in Some Guys for Jonathan Colton's purposes means this. He and a bunch of like-minded musicians have decided to as faithfully replicate as they can a bunch of really great male vocal hits from the 70s. And I just cannot wait for this to come out because I got to confess that I listened to a lot of this music already in its original form. And to have Jonathan Colton and his colleagues do it is just going to make it even more special for me. He's got America in there. He's got England Dan and John Ford Coley in there. It's crazy the wonderful concoction that he's put together. And if you're watching our video, you're seeing people riding down the beach on horseback, and it's just the most amazing thing. So I put it in. Jonathan was actually not Jonathan Colton, but Jonathan, our listener who sent this in, was a little concerned. Really, is there something that we could talk about on Twill about this? And yes, there are a couple of things. Number one is the fact that it's a good reminder that doing a cover song is something that is well defined and carved out under copyright law. There is a royalty that you have to pay. It is something in the neighborhood of 10 cents per copy sold. I'm not sure how that all translates out with streaming, I gotta say. But there are royalties that are carved out, and you can do covers, and it is a very well-established area of copyright law doing a cover song that somebody else has done. So he's on very solid ground there. The other thing that I thought was worth mentioning is the whole Some Girls, Some Guys thing. He has done a very faithful yet hilarious reproduction, remix, culture take on the Some Girls cover for this album, which is, I think it's basically Jonathan Colton's face in all the places where the Some Girls cover would have various other faces. And it's beautifully done if you're going to do the vinyl. I mean, I almost feel like I have to do the vinyl to have a copy of this, even though the only, there you go, you got a photo of it on the CD there. And then if you scroll down just a bit, Victor, you can see, oh, look at that vinyl thing. So the vinyl album actually has like some tie-dye involved on the vinyl. And then, of course, a very faithful yet parody reproduction of the Some Girls cover, and it's just going to be so fun. Love all this music to begin with. Love that Jonathan Coulton is remaking it in his own image, and that I don't think that there's absolutely any copyright issue with it, because his cover art, etc., seems very much in the school of Weird Al Yankovic parody, etc. I mean, it would be hard to. I don't know. I mean, I suppose there might be some trademark aspects there that people could talk about, but I really have a hard time thinking of the Rolling Stones coming after him about this. And then, of course, the cover songs themselves are very well protected under copyright law. Stefan, you want to chime in on this at all? Do you think I'm wrong?
No, I mean, it seems like a parody to me. I don't know the trademark aspect here, but I think he's going to be okay. I love that the story's here, because my wife was just listening to Jonathan Coulton the other day. We listen to him at home sometimes too, and so didn't expect to see him on the show. But I'm also a big Weird Al fan. My first concert was Weird Al. My daughter's first concert was Weird Al. So there's I love. The geeky kind of parody culture, and so this is right up my alley. So it's cool.
Incidentally, he wanted to raise $20,000. Basically, the album's done. He's got all the music done, and he wanted to raise $20,000 just to do the pressings on the vinyl and the CDs. And he's raised over $70,000 at this point. So there is enthusiasm about this work of art. Matt, will you be buying it?
There is, if you look on the Kickstarter page, the bottom one is $300 or something like that. And mm-hmm. It says mystery items. I definitely would have bought it for the mystery items, but there's already 30 backers, and unless he can open it up, I don't know what we're going to do. Also, if you're just listening on here, there's a great chart that says where the money goes, and it says 100% to him, which is just fantastic. Only other tidbit is
that it's a pie chart. It's 100% to him.
Yeah. Yep, it's perfect. And the copy's great on this, but the only other tidbit is that the Weird Al, I believe he got permission for all of his works. Not that he wouldn't have had a fair use argument for his, but I believe that he asked permission for everyone to parody their works.
You're absolutely right about that. And I guess I was sort of thinking of, I was sort of porting over the parody that Weird Al does to the recordings to the actual graphics and album art. And that's not an appropriate thing to do, technically, because the graphics and album art are a completely different work and may give somebody else something to talk about on the copyright front. But again, just, in that spirit, I guess is what I meant. I can't see the Rolling Stones or their label or whoever owns the rights to Some Girls, which is one of my favorite all-time albums, by the way. I will put that on and just rock out to Some Girls. But I think this Jonathan Coulton album is going to be one of the next favorites. I really don't see this being a huge problem for him. Bob, any thoughts?
So Denise, I think you're right on the legal issues, but mm-hmm. on the artistic merit, I have to dissent. I think these are all songs that should never again have seen the light of day. Jonathan Coulton's great. I love him, but not sure I'll be listening to this.
See, there's a whole genre of something called yacht rock that I think these pretty much fall into. And I got to confess, I'm a huge fan. It's what I grew up on. It's what, KFRC in the Bay Area when I was growing up, it was all this stuff. So, yeah, can't get away from it. All right.
I thought you were sort of in on the joke that he would only record this because he thinks it's terrible. But
I think he's recording it because he likes them. That's okay. What I'm going with.
I couldn't decide after watching the trailer whether he thought this was all a joke or not. But
it's an interesting question. I think there is some cherishing of this music going on, but it's just me. Getting back to Lawrence Lessig, because I wouldn't want our last episode of the show to be anything but a two Lessig show. There was a delightful little tweet I thought that was worth highlighting. that, you know, Lawrence has moved on from his copyright crusader days, and I'm sure all of those issues are still near and dear to his heart, and he's written so much and done so much on those issues, much to Stefan's chagrin, of course.
Boredom, not chagrin.
Yes. Stefan, I believe, actually, I found this because you had highlighted it on Twitter, that Axl Rose was quoting Lawrence Lessig on political issues. He quote tweeted from something that Professor Lessig had published at the Huffington Post. The tools are they who enable this constitutional immorality. Those fools are the Senate Republicans who have placed party over country and President Trump over the Republican Party, end quote, citing Professor Lessig. And Professor Lessig replies, doesn't get better than this. Clearly time to retire. And I would have to just take issue that it could only have been better if it hadn't been Axl Rose, but Lars Ulrich, who had decided to quote Professor Lessig on political issues, because of course Lars Ulrich was the person who, the musician who took great umbrage at Napster. He probably not the only one, but a very public one back in the early days of the Napster litigation. So could have been even just a tiny bit more perfect had it been Lars. And maybe Lars will find Lessig. What do you think, Stefan?
Well, first of all, woke Axl Rose was one of my favorite parts of Twitter a couple months ago. So that's primarily why I found this amusing and retweeted it. Less to do with Professor Lessig, who I have nothing but respect for. It's just that going back to the comment there. It's not that I have anything against him personally or copyright professors generally. It's just the contrast between how cool what artists are doing is and how deeply uncool the commentary on it is always kind of amuses me. In this particular case, you know, Axl Rose quoting Lawrence Lessig is just, you know, it's like Chris Novoselic from Nirvana. If you've ever gone to his Twitter feed, it is just the weirdest thing. And I love watching sort of relatively washed up, you know, formerly dangerous seeming musicians enter into middle age and just kind of have very weird social media profiles. And so I think Axl Rose surprised all of us, and it's just a delight.
It is. And I think you've just summed up our entire 12 years of This Week in Law. People commenting on the cool things that others have done and trying to unpack the legal implications. Right. It's pretty much what we've done. Matt?
I just want to live in Stefan's head for like an hour and just go through those things that just came out of his mouth and like actually understand them. I think that perhaps Denise undersold the happiness that could be gained above this. I'm sure that Lessig would probably want a new commander in chief rather than to be quoted, but that is the nature of things these days.
Yeah, absolutely. That's probably true.
Not going to happen today.
Would he want the new commander in chief or Lars Ulrich to quote him? I don't know. That'd be a toss up. It's a hard one to say.
Very difficult.
Bob? Yeah.
I think one of the greatest things about getting invited to be on the show today was discovering this tweet because I hadn't seen it. To me, this tweet is like, I mean, what better statement could there be of the times in which we live to have Axl Rose quoting Larry Lessig on the constitutional immorality of the Republican administration? It's perfect.
It's kind of perfect. All right. We wouldn't be an episode of This Week in Law if we didn't try and scare the pants off you a little bit. So we're going to talk about privacy. All right. I guess I should have checked this before the show, but I believe that Ring, the video doorbell, is no longer a sponsor on the network. Am I right, Victor?
Right, but you can still mention they used to be.
They used to be a sponsor on the network. I actually have, because they were a sponsor on the network, a Ring video doorbell on the front of my house, and I actually enjoy the thing and think about the privacy ramifications of it, as I hope that all the rest of the Ring video doorbell users do. There are a couple of things you should probably think about before you install one of these video security systems in your house. There are probably several things you should think about, but at least two that pop into my mind are from the legal slash, it's not so much a privacy thing as that video that is recorded is considered the same as recording just the audio. I'm saying this awkwardly, but if you have people at your front door who you don't know and you're recording their conversation and you haven't gotten their permission, that's something that could be problematic for you legally down the road, depending on the state that you live in. The various states have different approaches toward this, and there are two-party consent states and one-party consent states, and you better know where you're living if you have one of these things. So that's something to bear in mind, and if you're recording people's conversations, you might want to think about that. Secondly, and this is the story we have in the rundown, which is at tagpacker.com/thisweekinlaw, we're at episode 448. And in any event, if you are going to use a Ring video doorbell or any other sort of video surveillance system, and you're going to have that company store your video, you got to think about who's getting access to it. And that is what the story we have in the rundown is all about, that the security of access to the video that people have recorded on Ring is not that great, and that there have been episodes of people being able to access this video. And if you think about it, I mean, in my particular case, I don't think of the front door as such a security focal point, because we rarely enter and exit from the front door. So there's not so much that people could know about my family from having video of the front door. However, that's not the case for everybody. For various people, the front door is the only way that you get into and out of the house. And maybe that's something you should think about if you're going to store that video. If you want people to have access to an ongoing record of who's coming into and exiting your house, then having one of these is a really good idea. If you don't want to have that kind of ongoing record, then you might want to think twice. And this story at The Intercept is a great cautionary tale about what can be done with the video that is being stored about people's homes. And really, I think we're entering this era of people trying to build this shield around their house with technology. And maybe the shield is not as impenetrable as they think. Stefan, did you look at this, and what do you think?
I did look at this. I think it goes back to a general theme that we've touched on, I think, quite a bit lately. And it's just this idea that, you know, you can kind of sell anybody anything as long as there's some basic advantage they perceive in it. No matter how deep the costs are, if they're kind of out of sight, out of mind, people won't think about it, because it's like, oh, you know, this makes it less likely that somebody's going to steal my package. I want it. You know, I could put in the contract that as a result of this, you know, 15 polar bears will die, and people will say, well, you know, it's deep in the contract. I'm not, it's not, yeah. Not the thing I'm going to think about. So great example of that. You know, it's an interesting product in neighborhoods where you have a lot of people using it, because, you know, that sends you little notifications about what else is happening in your neighborhood. And it can actually have kind of a sinister tone to it. I mean, you know, you get a notification like every hour or so about some house getting burglarized or some package thief, you know, in particular on Christmas. And I think it sets a very negative tone about safety. And so there's a lot there that they're doing that I think might, with the benefit of hindsight, people might wish they sort of didn't sign up for. And, you know, I hope they find a way to to sort of smooth out some of those edges and get the product sort of delivering the service that people want without some of those costs.
Yeah, and I don't think that these products are really focusing on that as a consumer selling point. I think that they're trying to give you blanket protection and they're recording everything. And maybe that they need more fine-grained controls and that I'm not sure exactly how you would execute that. But it does seem like the whole neighborhood feature where you're sharing with all your neighbors is a little bit creepy. And that people maybe don't think that through to a great extent. And the fact that, just whatever cameras, I only have one on the front of my house. People can have them all over their house, inside and out. And, maybe you need to think about what sort of video is getting taken and where it's getting stored and what's getting done with it and what control over that you might have or not. So it's definitely a going forward issue. It's certainly not going away. Ring is not the only company. I mean, obviously it's got a huge market share and it got bought by Amazon, but there are lots and lots of other companies that are doing this and competing in the same space. And, the way to do that and have privacy, I think, is a good thing to think about. Bob, any thoughts?
I mean, what strikes me here is that it just seems that this company took a completely cavalier attitude toward customer data in who it provided access to. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of shocked by the story if what's written about here is in fact true. I think companies have a high obligation to their customers to be protecting their data, and that clearly was not done in this case. Interesting. I just wanted to mention in Massachusetts, where I am, kind of the one of the lead cases on use of video and audio involved a home baby monitor. And in Massachusetts, we are a two-party consent law, but only with regard to audio. You don't need consent with regard to video, only with regard to audio. And there was a case in Massachusetts where apparently some police overstepping was captured on a baby monitor. The people who lived in the house actually provided the video to a local news outlet that put the video up on its website, and a criminal complaint was brought under this law against the individual and the news outlet, and it failed because in fact it was just video. There was no audio, and so the consent law didn't apply. And in that case, the baby monitor actually proved evidence of police brutality is what it was in the case. So, kind of an interesting sidebar to what we're talking about here.
It is interesting. I wonder if there's a way that you could just to delete the video or I'm sorry, the audio portion of your video, because generally when you're recording video, you're also incidentally recording audio, but people don't really think about the legal ramifications of that. Matt?
I never really thought about the audio recording. I wasn't aware of the consent requirement for that, but I think it's, mm-hmm. Just thinking about the back end storage of this is just an example of a company that did a really poor job of, just managing how they manage their data. The protocols just seem way out of whack. It doesn't seem like, there doesn't seem to be any conceivable reason why the company would need access to the video or the storage. Seems like they just need to make it so that their employees don't have access to that. On a kind of funny note, my brother has one of these, and I don't think he's locked his door in the last 10 years. But I think he just really enjoys seeing people come to his door, which he doesn't lock, and thankfully they don't go in the house. But, people have these things for all sorts of reasons. And, as Stefan kind of brings up, it's another interesting tool that people use and pay for, and privacy goes out the door.
Yeah, and I actually think this is a good jumping off point to ask Bob about something that's more in his area of study and expertise, and that is sort of the legal technology arena and the choices that people make about where they're going to store what they're doing on a business front. And the fact that so much has moved to a cloud storage model over the last, I don't know, half dozen years, and that we just take it for granted now. But I don't think that people are necessarily thinking through what that means if we're going to store it locally or store it in the cloud. And I used to, I think, look askance at that point that I'm myself making now and saying, you know, of course you're going to store it with someone who's more reliable than you are, than has more storage capacity than you are, and that you do, and that can take security steps that maybe you can't as an individual. But I don't know that that's necessarily how things are shaking out. What do you think, Bob?
Well, you know, I look at it a lot. I mean, I think most people are not really paying much attention to the security of where they're storing their data. I look at it a lot from the perspective of what lawyers are doing, because of course lawyers have a higher obligation to ensure that the data they store on behalf of their clients is kept in a secure location, that the confidentiality of it won't be breached in any way. And it seems to me that a lot of lawyers don't think about it at all. And they should be, or they think about it. I mean, they kind of know in the back of their minds they should be thinking about it, but they're not giving full deference to it, or they don't really understand how to think about it or what the issues are, what questions to ask. I was talking this week to a company that will remain nameless that was telling me about how they're about to launch operations in the European Union that will involve a substantial storage of data in the cloud. And so I asked them about whether they're going to be establishing servers somewhere in the EU or somewhere outside of the United States. And their answer was, why? Why are you asking that? I thought, well, you might want to do some research before you proceed with what you're doing. It's funny how few people are really thinking through this issue of data security in the cloud.
Right, and how few people are thinking through the issue of, you know, what I was sort of wrestling with a few years ago, that maybe there are folks or companies or, you know, somebody you can put your trust in that, you know, again, as an individual, you're not really equipped to deal with all the data security issues. And is there someone where you can offshore that kind of concern? And I'm not sure there is. You know, I might have thought a few years ago that there was, and I'm not sure that I believe that now. Okay, so let's further to that point. Let's talk about our cellular carriers, shall we? Let's talk about the story from Motherboard that broke this week. That amazing journalism and reporting that has engaged a lot of lawmakers in the United States to address the issue. And we've had a lot of sort of scandals about social media companies this year. Let's talk about our cellular providers, shall we? And the fact that if we, again, sort of looking back at the stories that we've historically covered at This Week in Law, there were rules that were supposed to go into place last fall, that would have perhaps addressed this issue and would have addressed what folks could do with their telecommunications information and how they could store it, sell it, use it. And those rules did not go into effect. And we're seeing the fallout of it now. And what we have seen from Joseph Cox at Motherboard is this great story about how he gave a bounty hunter $300 to locate a phone, had the phone number of the phone, and within, you know, short order was able to have that phone located. And this is, I mean, I feel like 5 years from now, if we're looking back at archives of this week in law, people are going to go, oh yeah, how did you think this wasn't happening? But right now it feels new and creepy. And the fact that your cellular company is selling your data to, and we're not talking about data that you can control. We're not talking about data that where you could take a setting on your phone and say, turn off location services, for example. We're talking about data that is purely garnered from the fact that your cell phone connects to towers that let those towers and your cellular company know where you are. And that data gets sold and then resold and resold. And this is a really great article. I'm not going to try and do it justice in our show as we crank through stories here from Motherboard and from Joseph Cox there. But this story and this journalism that was done here has really alerted people to the fact that, oh, yeah, this is really a problem and that we need to clamp down on it. And lawmakers are paying attention to it. At least Kamala Harris and Ron Wyden are paying attention to it, and potentially others in Congress as well. And we need to let these people know that this is not okay. What do you think, Bob?
Yeah, I mean, it's just another example where we have companies that take a cavalier attitude toward their customers. We have a dysfunctional Congress that's not able to take action to address these issues. And it's the consumers who suffer. I think you're right that in hopefully in 5 years, maybe that's optimistic. I don't know. In 10 years anyway, we'll hopefully be looking back and thinking it was outrageous that this was going on. But but it's going on.
It is going on, and people need to know that it's going on and that it's not just something that they can turn off on their phone. Because I think that people think, oh, you know, location services, I'll just turn that off. And they don't understand that phones connect to towers and the towers know where they are. And that's a part of how the phones work. Stefan, any thoughts?
I'm just wondering how one becomes a bounty hunter, and what do you put on your LinkedIn profile? Do you call yourself a bounty hunter, or is there some sort of highfalutin way to say it? You know, I think, you know, jokes aside, this is obviously a very contemporary problem that nobody is really putting any weight into addressing, other than sort of saying, "Oh boy, we should solve this." And I do wonder what it'll finally take for someone to take it seriously in sort of a meaningful, you know, use of state or federal resources to address it. And, you know, then 10 years later, when people write about this kind of Wild West period that we're in now, I think everyone's going to think, whoa, that was nuts. And we'll all be sitting around campfires telling our grandchildren about, oh, yeah, you know, we were just sort of cool with it and everyone was fine. You know, I hope it doesn't take some crazy act of cyber warfare to really wake everybody up. But that's kind of, it seems that that's where we're going. We're going to build this infrastructure where everything is knowable and everyone's comfortable with it because it's in private hands. And then somebody flips a switch and all of a sudden it's in public hands in a way that nobody ever anticipated. And then it'll be too late. So
there's a guy quoted in the Motherboard story that broke all this, whose name is Thomas Ridd. He's a professor of strategic studies at Johns Hopkins University. He's not commenting on anybody's remix culture, as far as I know. but he does
say... Do you all get the... I'm sorry. You all get the annual email from Google telling you, showing you the map of where you've traveled during the year, the tracking they do? It's pretty weird.
Yeah, no, I think I've opted out of that. I think thankfully. So what Thomas Ridd says is, Blade Runner, the iconic sci-fi movie, is set in 2019. Do you all realize we are living in the year of Blade Runner? I suppose that acknowledges or that deserves some acknowledgement. And here we are. There's an unregulated black market where bounty hunters can buy information about where we are in real time, over time, and come after us. You don't need to be a replicant to be scared of the consequences. And I think the guy's dead on. And I do think that, you know, I mean, there have been several lawmakers who have responded to this reporting and have said, we're not going to let this stand. And the cellular folks have said, we're not going to let this happen. Or sorry, or, you know, whatever they say, it's just, you know, whoops, I guess would be the response. But they say this isn't going to continue, but I think that lawmakers aren't going to let this thing continue. But it seems to have less attention than the kind of privacy issues that we've paid attention to over the years, starting in April, relating to Facebook and other social media platforms. Matt, do you have any thoughts about how to bring this all together?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's almost disappointing how easy it was for the bounty hunter to get this information. You know, he may have to give back his title as a bounty hunter because usually it requires at least like a little bit of exertion. but, you know, in terms of, you know, I really recommend reading the story. I think it's a great piece of investigative journalism. It really covers, you know, sort of what's going on today, but also, you know, it is a really cavalier actions by these companies to be giving out this GPS information. I don't know why, but it seems more invasive when you're talking about where you are rather than selling, you know, sort of what you like to advertisers. I think that's the way I typically think about data being sold, is it's has to do with your habits and your likes, and they're just trying to get you better products. I think this is a good example of, you know, at least for my misunderstanding what's being sold, that it's your physical location, that it's where you are, and that it's so easily accessible, not just by, you know, an Amazon or a Google who's going, you know, yes, they're going to try to sell you something. You can live with that, but that I can call and get Stefan's location for $300 seems pretty scary.
That does seem scary. Let's hope you're not doing that. This is one of the most interesting stories I think we have in the rundown for the day, and the one that we have the least time to talk about. So I'm going to hope that you all go and read Cash Hill's story about how cartographers for the U.S. military inadvertently caused a house of horrors in South Africa. This is just an amazing, incredible story. And again, continuity between what we've talked about before. We've followed along as Cash Hill has discovered that there was a place in Atlanta and another, God, I forget, somewhere smack dab, supposedly in the middle of the United States.
Yes. Kansas, I think.
Yeah. Kansas, where cartographers have decided that IP addresses and map coordinates should match up. And unfortunately, they've decided that they should match up in some circumstances in people's actual homes, as opposed to like out in the middle of nowhere. And that's what's happened in this story here that we have in the rundown about the house in South Africa, where the poor couple living there has had to deal with people, you know, hunting down their lost iPhone or their lost computer, wherever it is trying to track to a location where it was last found. It is winding up at their house because their house was unfortunately designated. And if you go through the whole story, find out how the U.S. military and the, God, what is this thing called? It is called the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, which I had no idea even existed, but they have a huge role in mapping. And they unfortunately are now providing information to an organization called MaxMind. And by the way, just as like a super meta Twill commentary, if you will, for having played along with us for all these years. Tanya Forsythe is a counsel for MaxMind. She represents MaxMind and has been on our show before. And if you read through Cash Hill's article, she's quoted there. And of course, Cash Hill herself has been on our show multiple times. So definitely a Twill-rich piece here to read about what happened in South Africa and how this weird government mapping issue has got itself into the MaxMind database, and then it involves having the government change its coordinates, basically. Where is the center of town in South Africa in order to Pretoria, South Africa, in order to absolve these people of being, you know, where has my device been taken and absconded to in a criminal type sense? And they literally call their home the House of Horrors because this has, you know, resulted in multiple law enforcement people and other private individuals showing up at their home and saying, oh, you know, something terrible legally has gone on here. There is a high note to the story. They do seem to have been able to fix the problem. They would have been involved in an earlier fix had they only been in the top 100 sites that were impacted by this kind of thing. Instead, they were number 104. So they still had to contend with it until they notified the government agency and asked for the change. Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, just a bizarre story. Another really good piece of journalism to cover it and just to go through, you know, all of the ramifications that came about this. But, you know, you just feel bad for the people who were just continually, you know, had their door knocked down, knocked in, in order for people to get their missing and stolen items. So, you know, real tragedy for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Stefan, what do you think?
You know, I have to confess, I needed to read that story like two or three times before I understood what was going on. It's actually pretty confusing, not to sort of disparage
and
the journalists.
And long and dense. Yeah.
Yeah, but it was one of those things where I was like, how did this happen? And it was a great one of those, like, you know, the old premise that we're living in a computer simulation. Like, that's an example of, like, there's like a bug in the code and someone needs to go in and fix it. And then our computer simulation life will be a little bit more enjoyable because that shouldn't be happening. I mean, it was really weird. Yeah, I really feel bad whenever anybody's kind of home life gets caught up in this crazy tech, whether it's swatting is an obvious terrible example or something a little bit more innocuous like this. It just must feel so invasive and terrible. So those poor people.
Yeah, I feel good that Cash Hill has this terrible angst-ridden moment in her piece reporting on this where she says, I feel awful for all the people who have emailed journalists and have told them obliquely of problems that they are having and the journalists can't solve them because they're just too busy. And that seems to have been what happened here because these people emailed Cash Hill in 2016, I think they said, about their issue, and they sort of like didn't want to be immediately identified with the issue, and were kind of covering for the fact that they didn't want to let her know, hey, this is happening to our house. She eventually, being the good journalist that she is, figured it out and helped them. And she's right that there are probably a lot of other people that have this happening and have no idea and have never found a Cash Hill article. And let's hope they do, simply through search and the fact that this issue is becoming more visible. Bob, any thoughts?
Yeah, just two things. One is, I just want to say, I'm not sure there's a journalist out there who does a better job than Cashel of kind of capturing the nuances and outrages of the digital world these days. She's always a great read. She always does a great job. The other thing I just want to emphasize is, you know, you mentioned this National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, and she makes the point, this is the agency that provides the geolocation information to the U.S. military to help guide the military's bombing missions. So that's a pretty scary thought, that if they're getting this wrong, what else are they getting wrong out there?
Yeah, it is a very scary thought. And there's a reference to that story about the inaccurate bombing of something that involved China and should not. And I'm not doing justice to the details and the nuance of the story, but this happened a while back. All right. Yep. Let's go to what's next. Let's talk about kids. Okay, so COPPA is still there and still out there. It's our only national privacy law. It doesn't seem to be having a whole lot of impact or a whole lot of effect as we look toward the fact that other people need privacy protections too, not just our people who are 12 and under. So in any event, let's look at how COPPA is impacting those people who it is supposed to protect. Kids 12 and under, there is a new complaint before the FTC in the Google involving the Google Play Store that alleges that many of the applications there that are available for you to download to delight and distract your children are not COPPA compliant. And guess what? It seems they're completely, completely right. From what various researchers and studies have found, something like 73% of the kids in the kids' apps in the Play Store are not COPPA compliant. They're sending geolocation and other data to places that it shouldn't be. And it's not a good thing. So there is definitely some attention being paid to this, and suits and complaints before the FTC that are being brought. Now, the FTC doesn't seem to really have a lot of teeth to enforce this. And the Washington Post actually has a good article about this called it's a whole editorial board. It's an op-ed did this piece. The lessons we can learn from a complaint about Google's child privacy protections. And basically it's saying, you know, we really need more privacy protections for everyone, but if we're going to implement them the way that we've implemented COPPA, then maybe we shouldn't do it at all. Because COPPA is not being very effective. So the point of that piece is that, you know, the FTC has fining powers and regulatory powers to put a stop to these kinds of things. And it just isn't able to really follow through and make sure that people are putting a stop to these practices. Matt, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, just you know, just thinking about like the nature of trying to regulate, you know, something like apps or, you know, YouTube videos or anything like that. You know, just the pure speed at which they arrive and start and stop and start and stop and they get popular, you know, you're going to be able to regulate the popular ones. It's always going to be very difficult to regulate the unpopular ones or the new ones or anything like that. So I think the FTC is always going to have a difficult time. You know, I don't know. I'm not too familiar with COPPA. I don't know. Is there any action that can be brought against Google Play, or just because they're hosting these items rather than producing them, is there no liability for them?
Well, the complaint alleges that Google Play is vetting these apps by saying that there is this special portion of the Google Play Store that is for children's apps that they've approved. So they seem to be giving their stamp of approval to a collection of apps. So I would say that their ability to stand back and have a hands-off approach is impacted by that. That's what the complaint is saying. And to answer your question, you know, under COPPA, I don't think that there's actually any specific provision that deals with, oh, if you're an indirect or a direct provider of the service. I don't think that COPPA actually got that fine-grained. Yeah. Stefan, do you have any thoughts on this?
My favorite phrase in this article is toddler YouTube, the idea. It's like black Twitter. It's one of those phrases that it's the same overall problem that you end up with in a lot of these cases where the regulatory regime is sort of haphazard and left to the gumption of individual plaintiff's attorneys. And I don't know enough about the ins and outs of this particular statute, but you could see what's the concept of efficient breach. Like, you could see just people deciding there's more money to be made breaking this rule than there is in risk of you're ever going to get sued for it. So you're going to keep on breaking it. So what's the point, really? And as long as that's what's in place, then you're going to have the downstream negative effects that everybody tried to get rid of by passing legislation to begin with. So it's just kind of not to sound too cynical, but we get the regulatory regime we deserve, and you've got toddlers watching some truly weird stuff. If you let YouTube play long enough, it gets bizarre. and to some degree, parents should just not park their kids in front of YouTube. But I try not to be judgmental, because people get busy, and so maybe finding that right balance between parents sort of saying, I'm going to monitor what kids are watching, and the government saying, I'm actually going to hold these companies accountable. If we took it seriously, we could get a good result. Sounds like right now nobody's taking it seriously, and there's just some hand-wringing and sort of moral concern being expressed, but nothing being done about it.
Well, that's the follow-up story that we have in our rundown, is that it's not just about apps available in the Google Play Store. It's also about what's available on YouTube in general and what's being served up as palatable or acceptable youngster entertainment. YouTube's official position is that no one under the age of 13 should be using YouTube, because that is what they prescribe in their terms of service. And that is, you know, how the YouTube universe works. There is now a separate complaint, separate from this App Store complaint, that is saying that's just BS. And you guys know it's BS, and we all know it's BS, and maybe something more official should acknowledge that it's BS. And that is pending now, and we'll see what happens. A coalition of nonprofits have urged the FTC to investigate YouTube and its parent company, Google, for violating COPPA, despite the many laws that exist for kids' entertainment on broadcast television. COPPA is really the only law regulating kids' content online. So, you know, if you're just turning your kids loose on your TV with PBS or whatever else, it's far different when you decide that they can use your iPad or your phone and watch whatever they want to on YouTube. Bob, any thoughts about this?
I think that what the two things that jumped out at me, one was the article about the Google Play, the apps on the Google Play Store. Yeah. One of these apps with a million downloads teaches, this is a quote from the story, teaches children to clean their eyes with a sharp instrument. The other from the other story on YouTube that jumped out at me was that it said that 50% of kids under the age of 8 own their own phone. Those are some bizarre facts, I think, that really drive home the fact that Google has a very strong obligation to be monitoring the content and the apps that it's putting up there, that it's, you know, to the extent that it's labeling it as appropriate for children or marketing it in some way or organizing it in some way as appropriate for children. I don't know anything about COPPA, to tell you the truth, so I don't know what the enforcement mechanism would be under that, but it just seems that as a matter of corporate responsibility, Google has an obligation to be doing much more than it's doing here. I mean, that app, the one that teaches kids to clean their eyes with a sharp object, it said had more than a million downloads. So that's not, it's not some under the radar app.
Yeah, no, it's not. And there are two concerns, I think, here, not just COPPA, but also Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, where if YouTube and Google and every other online player does the right thing and allows people to host things on their platform without getting terribly involved in what's going on there, then they're protected in a safe harbor kind of way. And that hasn't come up yet. It seems like before the FTC, but it seems like it's very close to having that moment, because there is a tension between wanting sites to come in and say, as you said, Bob, maybe the cleaning your eyes with a sharp object video is not a good idea and we should take that down or not make it accessible. But at the same time, the more involved you get, the more problematic is your protection under the 230 safe harbor. So
I was talking more about the app. I mean, that one was an app, not a video. And I think the issue there is that Google is organizing these apps as, you know, and presenting them as family safe and family appropriate. I'm not even suggesting they take the app down necessarily, and I certainly would never suggest they take the video down, but it's a matter of how they're labeling them and presenting them and organizing them.
Yeah, it is a matter of that. And I think that's what they're getting in trouble for, that they're trying to create this universe of things that parents can trust and feel good about. And, you know, again, I feel like this sense of continuity back to the early days of This Week in Law, when I was just very happy to be here having conversations with people who were not 3 years old and who could talk about issues that I was interested in independently of my role as a mom and other things in my life. And the issue really seems to be that Google is setting up these realms where people can look at them and say, oh, so I'm a parent and I know that this is what is good for my child. Because again, you know, getting back to almost that cloud storage issue we were talking about earlier, I can trust this big company who's been through this rigmarole and knows how to do it. And, they're far more confident than I at these issues, where parents are almost offshoring those issues and saying, oh, you know, Google's got me covered. And that may not be a legitimate conclusion to make. All right, let's move on past kids to, what's our next? Crimes of Justice. So this is kind of a hilarious story that we're not going to spend too much time on. But because the government is in shutdown mode, you might want to be aware of the fact that the FCC has closed the majority of its operations, including its complaint operations. And that's where you're going to hear about it if you're using spectrum channels that you're not supposed to be using. There's this great article at The Verge by Russell Brand. How do we say his name? Brandom? Brandom. He has very rightly pointed out that if you want to be violating the FCC's spectrum laws, now might be the best time ever. Although, as he also says, as the IT underground says, don't do the router crime if you can't do the router router time. And he points out that people may just decide, even if the complaint takers are closed for the time being, they're going to open up eventually, and maybe people will hold their complaints until then, and you're going to be in trouble. So it's a dicey time to be engaged in spectrum piracy. What do you think, Stefan?
I love this story because I'm looking at a patent case right now dealing with a sort of somewhat related issue relating to RF spectrum. So I've had spectrum on the brain, and reading about this made me giggle. I just love the image of somebody, you know, setting up their router, accidentally clicking Japan instead of the United States, and sort of walking themselves backwards into an FCC action. Like, you can imagine this Kafka-esque scenario where all of a sudden they're being prosecuted by some overzealous government lawyer who just wants to win, which happens all the time with these things. And you know, he's up there like, look, I just clicked the wrong thing. I never intended to steal the spectrum. I love it. It's really quite funny. Don't steal spectrum.
Don't steal spectrum. And maybe the government shutdown is not the best time for you to think about
opportunistically
taking your first
spectrum.
Walk into stealing spectrum. Matt, any thoughts?
I think when Stefan rewrites the 2019 version of Les Mis, he just found his police character for that. yeah, it'd be perfect. But yeah, you know, I think that, you know, the time is now to go out and do all these illegal things with the government shutdown, although it seems like it could last a while.
Yeah, absolutely. Bob, any thoughts?
As Stefan and I were sitting before the show waiting to get connected, and we were a little bit delayed, we were pretty sure that it had to do with interoperability issues because of people tampering with the spectrum. So I have no thoughts on it, really.
Yeah, really.
as you could tell.
Just know that as the government's shutdown continues, the FCC is not on guard. And in fact, Ajit Pai, who, you know, would have gone and spoken at CES, and other government officials who would have gone and spoken on policy issues at CES, are not there because they can't be. All right. Let us talk about a trademark issue, if we could. Stefan, this is a piece at the TMCA, which is your firm's blog, written by Mike Keyes, who is my former co-host, and involving the F word, so, or obliquely anyway, and Simon Tam, and lots of things that we've talked about on the show in the past, particularly that the Supreme Court has come down on the side that trademarks that involve disparaging or what is the other term of art here in play?
Scandalous.
Thank you. That portion of the Lanham Act is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court has decided that they're going to take that up again. What the heck is going on here?
Well, nobody really knows at this point, but it looks like what they may be trying to do is confirm that what is true of disparaging marks is also true of scandalous marks. It seems unlikely that a unanimous decision from less than 2 years ago would get revisited on the substance. So maybe it's just an opportunity to clarify that that which is trademarkable and disparaging is trademarkable and scandalous. I don't know. One of the things that has been raised in the petition is a concern that if the United States allows this type of trademark, foreign countries will look askance at the United States as though it's some lesser country for allowing these words to be trademarked. And I think that is just so funny on its face that I really can't wait to see the amicus briefs on that. And I'm really excited about that piece of it, because this is, I believe the USPTO's primary concern is that, foreign bodies will come and start trademarking all sorts of swear words, and this will be embarrassing for them. So I honestly am as confused, I think, as anybody else reading this, and we'll see what happens as this gets litigated.
Right. And I guess as we should clarify for people who may not have read all of our discussion points, where the mark in question is F-U-C-T. There we go.
Right.
Right. Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, just that this is, this is the same argument they made in the TAM case. They said the same thing. One of the main concerns was that international bodies are looking at the trademark registration, and therefore we don't want any, in that example, it was the slants, and they didn't want anything derogatory there. So it seems like that's just going to be a loser. As Stefan said, it was a 9-0 victory. And, but the only thing they got going for them is this is kind of like the battle in loser's bracket, because the Federal Circuit typically gets destroyed when their cases go on review to the Supreme Court, and the trademark is 0-1 in the last couple of years. So it'll be interesting.
It will be interesting. Bob, any thoughts?
I want to be in the courtroom on the day that they argue the case so that I can hear the F word get thrown back and forth in front of the justices.
Yeah,
well, it's not the first time. It won't be the first time that that word has been an issue in a case before the Supreme Court, but not in a trademark context.
All right. Super interesting. Let us go on to issues of terms of service. There's a super interesting article at Harvard Business Review that I encourage people to read in its entirety that talk about how privacy and cybersecurity are converging, and here's what it means for people and companies. And I think that it's dead on, and it has sort of encapsulated, again, a lot of what we've done for the last 12 years here at This Week in Law, is that privacy and cybersecurity have been converging. And what I think is super interesting about it is it, again, refers to this concept of how are we going to manage these issues? I mean, security issues become something that I guess the state gets involved in paternalistically, and our privacy issues going to get be treated similarly. And there's a paper that is referenced here by this Harvard Business Review piece that addresses that and wonders if we're going to have lawmakers step in, regulators step in and decide that there are reasonable inferences that should be applied. This is called a right to reasonable inferences, rethinking data protection law in the age of big data and AI. And it is by Sandra Wachter and Brett Mittelstadt. And really, I think raises some big issues of, are we going to allow the court system, where we've left it so far, and people to enter into sort of nonsensical contracts where they're deciding, yes, I've decided that you can use my data for these purposes, but whoops, I really didn't think that through. And now you're doing this with it and it's not so palatable. Are we going to have government take a more paternalistic approach and say, you know what, people aren't really able to give that kind of valid consent, and we're going to make those decisions for them? Stefan, have you looked at this and what do you think?
You know, I didn't get a chance to get around to this one. I'm working on some pretty intense briefings, so I read the short articles and skipped the long one. But as a concept, it does it makes sense. I mean, I read the abstract, and I think I do think that the more people think about the convergence between privacy and cybersecurity, the more informed they get, and the less they take a trusting attitude towards companies just because they're private actors and not public actors, the more a sensible a regulation regime we will end up with. And in the meantime, we're putting a lot out there and we're not thinking about it, and that's going to catch up with us. It's just a question of whether it's something innocuous like Alexandria or AOC's, I'm not going to mispronounce her name on air, AOC,
good
dancing
move.
That's completely charming and only serves to amplify her popularity, or whether it's something totally embarrassing. And I think with the show ending today, I'm not going to stop reading about privacy. So it's not something I paid too much attention to before I started doing this, and now I've kind of gotten much more interested in it than I was before. And I hope that before too long, there'll be signs that we're moving in the right direction. And I think with some of the stories we've seen just in the past sort of 2 years, with some of the bigger data breaches, there may be enough of this entering the popular consciousness to see something fruitful emerge, hoping that the trigger incident isn't something that is too devastating.
Yeah, I think those are really good points. Matt?
Yeah, when you think about regulation in this area, as with any area, it's just this one just specifically complicated. Privacy is a very broad concept. We're thinking about, every part of your life is available right now, and so where do we find an easy one where you can get a win? This is, anytime you put in a regulation, you're going to have missteps. I think we've seen that in Europe as they've tried to implement their privacy issue. So, when you don't want it to be not only for the reason of, you want to see privacy go in, but you don't want to see privacy go in the wrong way. So you don't want to have a big issue bringing this about. So it'd be really nice to, pick some areas and start tinkering.
Bob, want to add?
Like Stefan, I haven't actually read this article. so I can't really comment in depth on it. I do think that I'm looking forward to reading it, really, because I think this whole issue of the inferences that we can draw from the data that's being collected about us en masse can be used for good reasons or can be used for bad reasons. And I think one of the critical factors is how they're collecting and using the data and the extent to which the data is being anonymized in the process. I mean, there's probably, some really interesting stuff that can be found out, say, in the realm of health by studying, the data that's collected about us. Or about income disparities, or about any other economic issues around the country. But the question is really, are they going to start to be able to use this data to find to if it becomes an invasion of privacy, when they're in somehow being able to look at patterns and find out information about me or you or my neighbor? That gets concerning.
Right. And we're talking, the article here is about reasonable inferences, and we'll come back to that in a little while, because I want to talk about, as we close out the show, we'll talk about your 2019 predictions for the world of legal technology. And I think that comes into play there. All right, let's move on to the realm of journalism and the First Amendment?
Bumper.
We found it. Our First Amendment story for this episode of This Week in Law has to do with politicians blocking citizens on social media and whether that violates the First Amendment. This is still an issue that's up in the air, and we just wanted to update you on the point. Obviously, it's a whole range of politicians who could be subject to this. But what's going on is it seems like courts are leaning toward, if you're blocking people and your social media platform, whatever that might be, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, however you are expressing yourself on social media or online, that people have the right to engage with you. And if you block them, that's going to be a violation of the First Amendment. That seems to be what we're seeing in the Fourth Circuit. We've had district courts in that area who ruled that, yes, these were violations. And then the Federal Circuit Court of Appeal, who ultimately ruled that a politician's Facebook page bared the hallmarks of a public forum where public speech, however undesirable, cannot be discriminated against. So the fact that a politician had blocked a person on Facebook was a violation. The reason this is all sort of worth watching, I guess, is that it's not isolated politicians that this is happening to. It's sort of every politician, right? Because, you know, more and more politicians are engaging with their constituents on social media. So we need to watch this issue and figure out what's going to happen. In the Second Circuit, there's a case involving President Donald Trump. And there are lawyers there who are going to make the argument that people that he's blocked on Twitter, for example, are subject to First Amendment claims that they couldn't have been blocked. So, Stefan, any thoughts?
This strikes me as really weird. I haven't read the decision, but the concept, I don't quite track how we get to a First Amendment violation from a blocking like this. I mean, it's not... Mm-hmm. It's not like I can kind of reach out and contact politicians and just sort of yell at them whenever I want to, other than through social media. And if I were doing that and they said, "Hey, listen, cut it out," I don't see how that, impacts my First Amendment rights. It seems like an odd construct. So I'm actually interested in reading the decision. I haven't had a chance to do that yet. I could see if there were sort of a really regulated official forum through which, citizens and politicians engaged, you couldn't then arbitrarily listen to some and not others. Maybe that's the concern, that they're sort of building toward a foundation where they want to have the right legal principles in place, even though they kind of don't make sense in this current context. But I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around how this sort of rises to the level of a First Amendment issue without having the context, admittedly, of the specific facts here. But it sounds like he was, he made an angry post. It was up. He was blocked for 12 hours, and then she unblocked him, and it kind of triggered this First Amendment lawsuit, which, I mean, query who brings a case under those circumstances. But, maybe there's a good principle there, but as applied here, it kind of sounds a little kooky to me, but what do I know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it dovetails into a story that we skipped earlier, and I didn't mean to, under our social media category, about the various folks coming into office right now who are having to decide, personal account, official account, et cetera. How do we manage that? Because there are ethics rules about how politicians handle their social media. They cannot allocate government funds to maintaining their social media account unless it delineates that they are that elected representative. So I think this all sort of dovetails in that if you're buying into and having a social media prevalent presence under these rules and in our modern world, that you might have to deal with more trolls than you would as a personal, private individual. Matt, what do you think?
I think I'm a little more sympathetic than Stefan is to the argument, although I'm with him on who would actually bring this lawsuit. I think that the facts under the case were that they had deleted the person's post and they were complaining about financial mismanagement of a local commissioner of some sort. You know, it seems problematic that, you know, your commissioners are allowed to stop posts that, you know, comment on their financial insecurity within the public sphere. I think that that's right at the heart of the First Amendment, is commenting on, you know, how your politicians are doing and how they're serving the public. So it makes sense. It would be, you know, it seems like an easy thing just to say, and not overly judicious or not overly problematic, just say, you know, this is a First Amendment issue, and just have it be that way.
One quick thought on that. So, you know, and I really don't mean to come off sounding like an originalist, because speaking of kooky, but anyway, you know, speech, you say it and it's kind of ephemeral and it goes away. The person was able to make a post, right? He made his speech. It was up for a while and then it got taken down. There's something odd about the construct of social media in terms of it kind of preserving speech for a while. And at one point, have you sort of exhausted your or sort of perfected your right? Is it, you know, once you've spoken, do you have the ability to then kind of insist that speech stay up? You know, it'd be one thing if he was being prevented from posting.
I think the analogy that you would use there is then to say, you know, it's like a book, right? So can the government stop you from publishing? Can they let you publish 15 books and then stop you from publishing the book? You know, your words have been published in some sense, but, you know, they don't remain published. So, I mean, that would be the argument I would try to use there, or like a newspaper. You know, you've published your comment on there, but you can't republish it if the, you know, local commissioner says you can't republish it.
Yeah, but it's I kind of see it as different from that, because when you're publishing a book, I mean, there are circumstances under which, you know, it goes through, like, you know, journalism, for example, it goes through a certain level of scrutiny. I guess maybe you have a First Amendment right to total BS and to put it out there, but to have it affiliated with a politician's Facebook website and or any kind of social media website and have it stay up there indefinitely, like, that just seems like a really weird way to interpret the right to me, because it's not like a book that goes out there and is sold in the marketplace. It stays up and is affiliated with the site of the person it's being directed at. Don't they have a countervailing right to control that to some degree? Yeah, it's an odd fit. Like, I don't know where the line is on this one.
I think that in any area of constitutional law where the originalists have abandoned originalist principles, it's within the First Amendment, which they've, you know, given sort of extraordinary exceptional rights. And that's been to the good and to the bad. I don't think there's be any question that Simon Tam's case, to bring that back, would have won under the originalist. I mean, in 1783, we enacted the Alien and Sedition Act, and that was the same Congress that you know, wrote the First Amendment, and they didn't see that as problematic. So I just think that's, you know, originalists want originalism except for the First Amendment. I don't think they want that with the freedom of religion either.
I think the issue here is that the government official in this case made the Facebook page designated as a government page. She labeled it as an official government page, even though it was her own page that she maintained. Mm-hmm. She took comments from other people. I think she could have said, I'm not going to take, you know, she couldn't on Facebook, but she could have put a page up where she could say, I'm not going to take comments from anybody, and that would have been okay. But she can't take comments from the people whose comments she likes and not take comments from the people whose comments she doesn't like. And I think that's really the issue here.
Yeah, you know, that that starts to make a little bit more sense, because I think with the book analogy, I think what was bothering me about it is when you publish a book, you publish it under the imprint of whoever's consenting to have it published. When you put something on someone else's social media, it gives it sort of the stamp of the person whose post it's on, you know? And so it looks like she's endorsing it, even if she's not. And I think that creates a tension that that is a little different from publishing, because you can't. You know, you have a First Amendment right to, let's say, publish a book. You don't necessarily have a First Amendment right to publish a book and sort of pass it off as someone else's endorsement of your book. I think that and that's where this starts to get a little dicey.
No, and if you analogize this to a brick and mortar public meeting, a school committee meeting or something like that, the citizens have no First Amendment right to go in and speak at a citizen at a school committee meeting if the committee doesn't want to allow public comment. But if they do start to allow public comment, then they have to open it up to everybody who wants to comment. They can't discriminate against you based on what it is you want to say at that meeting. One aspect of this case that we haven't talked about that I think is kind of interesting is how it might interplay with some of the ethics opinions that have come down regarding judges' use of social media, because in at least some states, there have been rulings that judges have a responsibility to block certain people, such as lawyers who might come before them or litigants on social media. If that's a state where those judges are elected judges and therefore politicians, I wonder how the First Amendment analysis might play into those ethical prohibitions.
Yep.
I don't have any answers, but it's an interesting thought.
Okay. Denise had to take a quick break. Do you have anything to follow up with that, Stefan?
Yeah, I guess, the just kind of going back onto the book thing, like I do find it just a really interesting line. Like, is a post you make on social media like a book, or is it like something you say? And does that have any significance under the First Amendment? I'm not by any stretch of the imagination a First Amendment lawyer, so I don't know the answer. But there is something, it seems to me different, in particular when you associate it with the profile of someone else, because you're sort of then affecting essentially their First Amendment rights, you could see it that way anyway, because it's then their profile is sort of speaking in a sense, because it's projecting the words you've put there. And I think it's not something that lends itself very naturally to this type of analysis, but you can see, it's like when someone posts something really embarrassing on my Facebook, I sometimes feel the need to delete it, because I don't want to be associated with it, and I didn't consent to be associated with it. And so I have this temptation to delete it, because it feels like to the outside world, I'm endorsing it somehow by it being there. And so there's just a kind of an odd nuance there that, that doesn't really have an analog outside the social media or, digital realm.
There isn't an analog. My day job is working with newspapers, and I deal with newspapers on a lot of access issues. And I think there is a lot of politicians tend to forget that they serve the public, and they run for office. It's a voluntary thing that they run for office. It's a voluntary thing that they might take on some role in local government or state government. And they want to think that they still get to act like a private citizen after they get to be elected. And it's not the way it works. I mean, if you're going to put yourself out there to serve the public and to be essentially an employee of the public as a government official, then you have to be open to putting your stuff out there and engaging with the public. That's what it's about. And if you're going to be on Facebook and you're going to be actively talking about government issues on Facebook, you have to expect that you're going to be engaging with the public on that and not blocking those who you don't like. So I am sympathetic to this issue. I like the way the case came down, and it makes sense to me.
And I think that the way that the First Amendment works from a technical way analysis is that your first question is it speech? And then is it protected speech? And there's a couple things that aren't protected, disparate instrument, traditional things like that. But after that, it goes straight to, is there a compelling government interest in restricting it? And then if so, is this the least restrictive means to do that? And I think that they're going to have on those back end questions of, is it a compelling government interest and is it the least restrictive means? On blocking someone from Twitter, that's just going to be a very difficult thing to prove in front of a court.
Yeah, and I think if you accept the analogy of Twitter or Facebook as being sort of a public forum where that is sort of no different from a council meeting, and you've allowed people to speak, then they should be able to speak in an unlimited way. Then that all makes sense. I still struggle a little bit with the particular quirks of a social media platform, even if it is being used by a politician. I don't know what's in that Pandora's box if you open it up that way. What are the implications of this, and what could a really creative lawyer do with that once you've set it up? And will it just sort of chill? Will it have sort of this perverse effect of then encouraging politicians and others to not participate in social media because it's just not worth the costs that come with it? And I don't, it's not an issue I've studied in any meaningful way. I do just find that the combination of how carelessly people behave on the internet with how permanent it is to be a little interesting, because it's you may say or do something in the heat of a moment and that moment passes and you can move on. When you do that on Twitter, it sort of stays there, and you've seen, not to kind of excuse Kevin Hart's early tweets that were quite offensive. It's just, if he had said that at a comedy club and moved on and grown, he would have been able to put it behind him and move on with his career. He's not able to do that because of the unique dynamics of how social media works. And so there are implications there that I'm not sure we've fully weighed. And if you create a regime that makes it very difficult for people to feel like they can communicate honestly or extensively through social media because the costs are very high, you may end up sort of inadvertently discouraging people from using it in ways that could otherwise be useful. And so it's not something I've studied, so I'm sort of speaking extemporaneously here, but I do find ultimately there to be something a little bit odd about the way we're conceiving of the intersection of sort of public and private rights as they play out on social media.
Yeah, I think it really comes down to the question of how you use the social media platform. I mean, you could be a public official, you could be a government official, and continue to maintain a completely private presence on Facebook, in which you're going to just keep it to your, close friends and family. Or you can put up a public page that perhaps is meant to fuel your future campaign or whatever else. And if you're going to do that, if you're going to put up that public page and talk about yourself as a government official and talk about the work that you're doing as a government official, then you've turned that page into a public forum, and you got to deal with the consequences.
Yeah, and I think this is a good time to bring up the story that we skipped, which is about the incoming elected officials and how they're dealing with the fact that they have their own social media presences and now are becoming public officials, and that there's no real roadmap for that. There is the members' congressional handbook that doesn't say they're required to make new accounts once they become elected, but they have these obligations to disclose who they are and what they're doing on social media if they are a public official. And so that, as a practical matter, what they're doing is they're forming new accounts. They also have obligations not to put the funding behind their current office behind a personal social media account. So it makes sense for them to make these demarcations, but it's all sort of, I think, open area at this point, and that there are scenarios where people could have it. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, why should there be artificial demarcations between what Beto O'Rourke does as a congressperson and what he does, when he's sitting in his tennis chair? He probably feels like those are artificial boundaries, and maybe they are. Bob, do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think President Trump has set the standard for how elected officials can use social media, and the rules are there are no rules.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think, you know, I think it's wise perhaps for any organization or body to provide guidance and advice to its members or executives or employees or whatever they may be on smart use of social media or appropriate use of social media. I mean, just the issue we were just talking about, you know, what are the First Amendment implications of using social media? It's good to prep people on that stuff and make sure they understand it. But I don't think that anybody, particularly an elected official, should be restrained in any way in their use of social media, and that it ultimately it's up to them to make the decisions about how they're going to use it and what they're going to do there.
Yeah, it feels like this issue of, you know, if you're going to have an official account or a private account and how you're going to manage those is something we've grappled with throughout the 12 years of This Week in Law. And I'm just wondering, Stefan, if you feel like there's any more clarity there, or is it more confused than ever?
You know, with Trump's use of Twitter, I think where the confusion is like, at what point is something that he's tweeted an order, for example, you know, like that, mm-hmm. that starts to become truly confusing in a way that I think is new. I think the line between private and public use of social media is going to remain confusing unless it's drawn very clearly. I think what's going to make it in particular confusing is if you start introducing things like, you know, Instagram stories or Snapchat's equivalent, where something's up for a little bit and then it's gone by design. Like, how do you deal with that in the context of public regulations? I mean, something that was fleeting, yet somebody screen grabs it, then is it permanent? Is it fleet? You know, did it go away? Is it regulated differently? If you use your Instagram ability to kind of designate close friends and you're a public official, have you done something improper there? You know, with every twist, every new development, it may trigger some new scandal or crisis for politicians who are using this stuff, and it might just be deemed easier to not do it at all, rather than try to stay on top of all the nuances. And I don't know. I mean, there are good reasons why I will never run for office, and one of one of them is just it would just be such a headache to try to, you know, walk this line.
Yeah. Well, as far as the stories question goes, that's something Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez seems to be squarely addressing. She wants to be posting her Instagram stories, and she just wants to make sure that she's on a platform where she's not going to get in trouble for doing so. So I don't think that issue is going to go away because people just are going to say, oh, no, we're not going to use that terribly effective way of reaching my constituents. What do you think, Matt?
I don't really know what problem Congress was trying to solve here when they, like, I've never heard of a congressman who isn't, you know, very egotistical and loves to say that they're congressman. Like, what problem is that exactly? So, I don't know. I think that, you know,
if it's in there, the first and foremost problem they seem to be addressing is it's not going to be disclosed in their bio. And you're saying it's always going to be in their bio. Yeah, I'm with you. Okay, let's move on to some stories about robots and the Internet of Things. Okay, Bob, I love this story that you posted about this obscure case in Canada where some lawyers who were seeking, parties who were seeking attorney's fees for what they'd done in litigation got themselves bench slapped by the judge. It's really sort of a small case to extract some larger concepts out of, but it is interesting to look at and see that a judge is looking at these particular components. The ones I'm most interested in have to do with the crux of your article, which is about if they had used artificial intelligence means to do their research, it might have cost less, and that thus they could, you know, make a motion that would have entitled them to less money. And then along that same lines, I thought it was super interesting that the judge also brought up, oh, by the way, you know, you could have accessed all this case law that you were looking at in analyzing this case and making arguments before me, your judge, in a free way rather than in a paid way, which I think is pretty, you know, a pretty revolutionary thing for it to say, because so much legal research is so expensive. So why don't you chime in on both those points, Bob?
Yeah, it's in the scheme of things, it's a pretty minor opinion, but it was interesting that this was a case where these lawyers were trying to get reimbursement of the money, the fee. They had won the case, essentially, and they were trying to get reimbursement from the other party for the attorney's fees and the various costs that they had spent. And the judge really had gotten out of bed on the wrong side that day, I think. I mean, the judge just started attacking them from the get-go in this opinion. But, you know, among the things he said, as you just said, was, you know, they asked for $900 for legal research fees, which, you know, that's not a lot of money in the scheme of litigation. But the judge said, had they used artificial intelligence, their costs would have been significantly reduced. I don't really know whether the judge had any idea what he was talking about here, because I'm not really sure what AI, I mean, there are some, you know, AI legal research services out there, but whether you could have just jumped in with this issue and significantly cut down a $900 bill, I'm not sure you could have. But, you know, I think the bigger thing here is that this is a sign of things to come. You know, increasingly judges are impatient with lawyers who are not savvy about using technology in their practices. If they don't know how to get something for free that they can get for free, judges are not going to let them get reimbursed for that. If they don't know about how to use the current technologies that can help them keep their costs down or get better results, judges are not going to be sympathetic to that. I mean, this has been something we've been seeing already in the area of electronic discovery, where judges have for some time been requiring lawyers to use the latest and greatest and fastest technology. So I just thought this was interesting that a judge had – I think it was probably the first time I had seen kind of a judge officially call out lawyers for not using AI, and so worthy of note.
Yeah, and in addition, there was a notice of, you know, you could have gotten access to this case law in a free way,
yeah,
rather than paying for it. And that's pretty huge. I mean, most lawyers in most law firms are paying enormous, even if they're not directly doing it themselves, their firms are paying huge subscription fees to be able to access databases of case law that they can research. And here the judge was like, you know, you could have gotten that for free.
Yeah. So, as the token Canadian on the panel, I'll point out that there's a website that I just shared in the chat, canly.org. And it's sort of like, you know, the interface anyway is like a low rent version of Lexis, but it is all free and you can very easily search law on it. So that may have been what he was referring to.
He mentioned it.
Okay. Yeah. Got it. And I'll point out as well that this particular judge referred to the president of the United States as an odious buffoon in connection.
Do you think that affected his decision?
No, unrelated. There was a controversy in Ontario where this took place, where an Ontario judge wore one of those red hats with the famous phrase on it, and he was, you know, there was a hearing about it, and Justice Whitten then called him an odious buffoon, which I just, you know. I haven't quite heard those two words put together like that in this context, and it's just fun to say. So,
yeah. Well, this judge also called the motion by the attorneys in this case. He described it as schizophrogenic, which was a word I had never heard before. But if he's going to be talking about the president of the United States, that might be a word he wants to use there as well.
Absolutely. It goes right along.
This is what happens in these small town Canadian judges. They get the $7 word that they like and they stick with it.
I don't know. Sign of things to come. The legal industry, take notice. You may have to moderate the way you do research and analyzation. Let's move on to patents real quick.
That one's my favorite.
Yeah, I know. Matt, I put this in here for you. Apparently, there are some changes being adopted to guideline. I mean, it's like the craziest little niche story. There are some changes in guidelines for the USPTO that can make a huge difference in... By the way, the USPTO is not shutting down with the rest of the government. They are funded by their fees that they collect for registering patents, et cetera, trademarks. So they're not shutting down and they are enforcing these guidelines, and their new changes to the guidelines mean that we might see a resurgence after Supreme Court precedent to the contrary in software patent availability. Matt, have you looked at this at all?
So I didn't actually get a chance to look at this, but just to kind of give an overview of what I know about this, it's just really important what these guidelines say, because the people making the decisions about patentability, they're not reading Supreme Court precedent. They're not going through and looking at Alice for the factors. What they look at is what they're given. And so, you know, in the analysis that they're making, that's what they're looking at. And just to talk about a little bit about the timing that they have, typically a patent is reviewed in 15 or 18 hours, and they're making a decision about whether this is original and whether I believe the question in the article was about abstraction and to come up with whether this idea that's being put into place in a computer is whether it's abstract or not abstract or too abstract is a difficult thing to do, and so these guidelines really matter.
Yeah, it would seem that they do, and so there are changes that have been proposed and are in effect. Actually, there's nothing that I guess there is a comment period on some of them. So if you're especially exercised about the fact that software patents may become more available, then you should pay attention to this issue and perhaps comment on during the comment period. But that's what's going on here, is that software patents, which seem to become less available under recent Supreme Court precedent, are becoming more available under, as Matt explained, the actual guidelines that the patent examiners use to decide cases. So something to pay attention to and definitely chime in on if this is something that is near and dear to your heart. Stefan, any thoughts?
Yeah, the interesting thing about this is, we usually hear about Alice in the context of litigation, and there's been a lot written about it. And there's, a lot of major movement at the Federal Circuit invalidating a lot of patents, and that's sort of now been shifting in the other direction in light of some recent decisions. This is in the patent prosecution context, and I think patent prosecutors have been sweating bullets for a while now because of Alice, and this is sort of their revenge. So I think of this a little bit as Revenge of the Nerds, and they're going to come back. they're going to get all their patents back, I don't think it's a surprise. A lot of people predicted that this would happen, and good luck to anybody trying to implement this. It's if you can make sense of it, I'll give you $10.
There we go. We've got a deal. Yeah. Offer on the table.
Yeah,
all right. Let us move on to legislation, regulation, and policy. Okay, I can't believe it's taken us this long to get around to Paul Manafort. Bob Ambrogi. There is an amazing article at Wired about Paul Manafort being bad at basic tech. But what's much in the news this week is that his lawyers, not just Bob himself and the various things he's done that have made life difficult for himself and easier for the people investigating him, but his lawyers have learned a lesson about redaction that it seems like the most basic kind of lawyers at the most basic kind of firms should already know. Do you have any thoughts about this?
I have a lot of thoughts about this. And this isn't just Manafort's. I mean, this isn't just Manafort's lawyers. And I actually wrote my own piece for Above the Law a while ago on a whole different situation where it was Department of Justice lawyers who did the exact same thing.
Exact
I mean, we think of the DOJ lawyers as the preeminent lawyers in the country, yet they were called to task when they did the same thing. They filed documents on PACER that they had not properly redacted. They thought they'd redacted them. A journalist downloaded the document and did the good old copy and paste was able to reveal the text of the other of what was supposed to have been redacted. And
so unpack that for us. How does it work, Bob?
If you have not properly redacted a document, a PDF document, then you can simply do a select all on the PDF document, Control S if you're on a Windows computer. I mean, Control A, and then Control C for copy, and then go paste it into a Word document or something else, and you will see the unredacted text. You'll see the underlying text because it's both an image and a text. You know, a PDF document is an image file, but there's an underlying text file there. And a lot of people think that if they block out the image, then you're good. But in fact, you have to block out the text. People are seeing
like this overlay of the black redaction. And then
it's hard to imagine how they're not even doing it properly. I mean, if they've got Adobe, document cloud, then I don't know how they're not doing it or any major PDF software. But it's happening frequently. This does implicate this whole issue. And I think you mentioned it here in your outline of this ongoing, evolving, really, a responsibility for lawyers to be competent in technology. The ABA in 2010 passed this model rule, or 2012 rather, I think it was, passed this model rule that says that lawyers have an obligation to keep abreast of and be competent in technology. And more states, we're up to 35 states that have adopted that rule now. And this is just, one example among many of how lawyers are risking getting in a lot of trouble because they're not able to do simple things like redact documents or encrypt emails. And it's going to get them in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, really, do you think that there's much hope? I mean, I really don't feel like the legal profession in the 12 years that I've been doing this show has come a long way in adopting these kinds of technologies or figuring out that they need to think twice before they just produce a document and it's got a blackout that can be then copy and pasted.
I've been writing about this stuff for even longer than you, and I thought after a couple of years everybody would figure it out, and it's been a long time and nobody's figured
it's
it
not.
Out. I'll speak to a group of lawyers. I might speak to a group, might be 500 lawyers in the audience, and I'll say, how many people out there know how to encrypt an email? You might see five hands go up. They don't even know something like that, and they're ethically obliged to encrypt emails in some circumstances, and they don't know how to do it. It's a real problem.
You alluded to the fact that there are states that are cracking down on this, and are saying
cracking down is a strong statement, but they're passing rules that I don't think the states fully understand or that the lawyers fully understand. And no, really, I think that if you look at some of the ethics opinions that have come down on this issue so far, you know, I think I was alluding to this earlier, but there's this, the fact is that the ethics opinions say that a lawyer can kind of outsource their technology expertise. You can bring in a third party consultant or whatever else to help you with technology in complicated cases. But the lawyer never loses his or her overall responsibility for managing that case. And that means, you know, you can't manage something that you don't understand. And you can't manage a case with a heavy technology component or any technology component if you don't understand the technology. And I think a lot of lawyers just don't get that.
Yeah. All right, Stefan, anything about Paul Manafort that you want to weigh in on?
Yeah, two quick points. One, I don't think we should discount the possibility that they did this on purpose. You know, having a redaction error of this type would be a great way to leak information that, mm-hmm. you know, turns out could have some value both for their client and, you know, in terms of signaling what he knows and to the people who, you know, let's face it. I mean, he's in bed with some pretty frightening people who, you know, they may have made a determination that it was useful to inform them what he has been telling the government. So we shouldn't discount that possibility. The other quick point is, you know, I always laugh when it comes to like legal tech stuff and security, because I don't know a single lawyer who hasn't sort of in the middle of a research assignment just gone to Google and typed in some search parameters that inadvertently would have revealed some privileged aspect of their client's case. And so you can encrypt the emails till you're blue in the face, but if you then turn around and go into Google and say, you know, is this a waiver and sort of start, you know, putting in details, well, that's recorded somewhere, you know. And if you do that enough, all of a sudden someone has access to all the legal questions you're researching, and they could, you know, probably hire a bounty hunter and you know, figure out what your brief is about before it's written. And so it's Paul Manafort's original mistake, I think, with the WhatsApp thing that he was doing and got caught. It wasn't that he made a mistake. It was that he was sort of not thinking about the other side of it, I think. And so, you know, the person on the other end of the conversation, I mean. And so same thing with, you know, we could put in all sorts of security parameters, but if you just sort of casually then turn around and use a website that you always use and don't think about the fact that you're constantly being surveyed and everything you put into that search box is being recorded somewhere, who cares if you're encrypting your email? You've just essentially outlined your brief for Google. And what if you're litigating against Google? You know, like, then what do you do?
And lots of people are.
Yeah. God forbid you should go to Bing, but that might be where it goes.
Well, yeah. You know, all the major legal research services are, in fact, logging all of those queries that you do. I mean, Westlaw and LexisNexis and right. all the others do keep all that stuff.
They keep the Google searches?
No, they keep the searches that you – if you're on Westlaw and you do a query, all those queries are being logged and saved and analyzed. They use them to try and – I mean, there is a machine learning component certainly in Lexis and Westlaw that it uses these queries to get smarter and to deliver better results. And you know, it's anonymized in some way, but, you know, as Stefan suggests, depending on the specificity of the query, you can be revealing something about your client or your case.
Yeah, it's just, yeah. Okay, shall we move on to, oh my goodness, where are we? Let's go to other. All right, that's our last bumper of the last episode of This Week in Law, and one of my favorites because it's just so ambiguous. One of my favorite stories for this week has to do with the fact that I've been, you know, waiting the entire time that we've been doing this show for cars to fly, and now Elon Musk says they may. He made some sort of oblique comment that if we took some things out of the Tesla Roadster and put in SpaceX thrusters, we could have a hovering Tesla. And so there you go. I'm just happy to know that this is a possibility and that all of the legal ramifications of it go along with it. Matt, any thoughts?
Every time I think about SpaceX and the Tesla, there's this really quirky thing. They actually have a school inside of space. I think it's inside of SpaceX where like his kids and 20 other kids go to. I'm pretty sure like every invention is just made up by these kids. And then the best engineers just go out and do it. I think it's awesome. I have a hard enough time just driving regularly. But if my car could fly, that'd be great. As long as it's self-driving.
Right. I just, the self-driving car is scary enough, but if it's going to hover and fly, then, that's a whole nother ball game. Stefan, any thoughts?
Every rap crew needs a hype man.
Yep. Absolutely. All right, let's move on to our other story, which is Bob's wrap up. It's comprehensive. You're going to need to spend some time with it, of his legal technology developments for 2018, which help you understand, of course, 2019. My particular areas of interest, Bob, that you hit on, because you hit on 20 this year as opposed to just 10. Included things about AI, which I think, we've touched on a little bit, but we've touched on a little bit in that AI might be mandatory for people. But as far as like replacing lawyers and DIY legal services, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
It's a really an interesting time in legal technology because there is just so much going on. And that's kind of why I did 20 this year as opposed to I usually do 10, 10 of the sort of the top developments of the year. AI is still something that is dramatically overhyped in the legal profession. There are very specific applications of AI that are proving to be useful, but we're a long way from robots replacing lawyers. To the extent AI is being used in any kind of legal purposes, it's being used to supplement and enhance the work that lawyers are doing. One of the big areas is like in contract review, where lawyers have, thousands of documents to review as part of a due diligence review in a big corporate acquisition or something like that. And you can train an algorithm to look for certain kinds of clauses and keep avoid having to have lawyers read through all those documents and find them. But that's really a pretty limited application. And that's not really a matter of applying intelligence. That's really a sort of sophisticated natural language processing and machine learning aspects, not even machine learning really in a lot of those cases. We're not at the point of lawyers replacing lawyers, of robots replacing lawyers, but it is really developing. One of the really interesting areas is analytics, which is, you can kind of talk about whether analytics is AI or not, but something that's been happening more and more over the last couple of years is that these companies are going through and mining all this court data that's increasingly available online. The court data is pretty boring. It's, the date the case was filed and the judge and the papers that the parties file in the case. But when you go through and apply some analytics to all this data, you can start to get some really interesting information about judges' tendencies, how they're likely to rule, whether they favor plaintiffs or defendants, how well certain lawyers or certain law firms do before certain judges in certain kinds of cases. So it can really change the ball game in terms of litigation. It's money ball for lawyers, as they say. But it's a fascinating area, and it really can give lawyers, I think, a real advantage. So I did hypothesized about, are we going to get to the point where, you know, it would really be malpractice for a lawyer not to be using analytics when they're litigating a case, because the information you can get out of this is really, really fascinating.
Yeah, that is really fascinating. It seems like the kind of information that lawyers have traditionally tried to garner about their cases and what they're working on, just without all of these technological tools.
Well, the way you do it in the past would be you'd email, email the other lawyers in your firm and say, has anybody ever been before this judge, and what kind of a judge is it? And, you know, that would be it.
Let us look at sort of the anti-Manafort aspect of this. Do you think we've talked a lot about things Paul Manafort and his lawyers should have done or not done in their approach toward really just management of their data and life. Do you think that you're going to see more state bars cracking down on those sort of things, particularly on the legal front?
You know, I think state bars will be slower to crack down on it. You know, we have seen a couple of two states, in fact, now, Florida and North Carolina, are requiring lawyers to do continuing education courses in technology in order to keep abreast of technology. I don't know how much you can really learn in those. It's like 3 hours every 3 years that they're required to do. So it's not in-depth technology training. I'm not sure the bars are going to be the ones that are really going to crack down on this. I do think it's going to be, as we were talking earlier, the judges who are going to be impatient with lawyers not adapting to technology and not properly using it, and judges and clients. Increasingly, it's the clients who, more than anyone, are pushing lawyers to be using technology. When you tell a lawyer, I've got a tool here that's going to allow you to, cut the time it takes you to do this work. Well, lawyers get paid by the time they spend doing work, and they're not very sympathetic to that sales pitch. But when you tell their client that you've got a tool that's going to save them money if their lawyer uses it, then the clients stand up and pay attention and start to ask their lawyers, well, why aren't you using this? Because, you know, you're charging me an awful lot of money, and they're telling me you can save some money. So I think clients, I think judges, the pressure is going to come from not from lawyers to change, but from outside forces.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And the other thing in your 20-point list of important legal developments for the last year that forecasts what's going to be important for this year, obviously, is the blockchain. And you sort of mentioned that it was ascendant and didn't really talk too much about it. But I'm wondering what you think about it as this important aspect of replacing what we think of as conventional contract law and streamlining and supplementing what people do in that arena already, and maybe even obliterating traditional sort of norms of contract formation.
You know, I think when we talk about like smart contracts using blockchain, we're not really even necessarily talking about contracts. We're basically talking about contracts that are working together with some code or some technology aspect to monitor the execution of the contract. I think it's a long time before contracts themselves really change, but I do think that, as I say, blockchain is going to become really critical in the execution of those contracts, the ability to determine and verify when events under a contract have been performed, and when, you know, that might trigger certain other events. I mean, something gets delivered, therefore the payment gets released. You know, that in its basic form is what a smart contract can do. You know, I think the other big promise of blockchain, there have been very few applications at this point that have been developed for legal using blockchain, but you know, I think the other big promise for the blockchain is sort of as a vendor neutral identity verification, whether identity of people, identity of documents, identity of transactions. Most of that stuff is to the extent though there are standards for that now, they tend to be vendor driven or vendor developed standards, and I think blockchain will take off in terms of driving vendor neutral standards around those kinds of issues. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you so much, Bob Ambrogi. You've been just the most amazing final guest for This Week in Law. And we've been so excited to have you. And we're going to go ahead and move on to our concluding material for the show, which is going to involve, let's start with our tips of the week, which involves something I was not aware of until last night, and I'm not sure too many people are aware of yet. And it sort of makes a nice juxtaposition for the fact that Apple has been trolling people at CES this week with its privacy billboard. It has decided that it has a high ground to take as far as Google and Amazon are concerned. As far as telling people that what starts on the iPhone stays on the iPhone. Well, maybe that's the case. But they also have this facility built in that appears to have been given, it's called Live Listen, so that folks can have an enhanced ability for hearing impaired people to use AirPods, and that's all well and good. But what they don't seem to have figured out is the unintended consequences of this feature, which is essentially you can lay your iPhone down anywhere, outdoors, indoors, what have you. If you have AirPods and an Apple Watch or an iPhone, you can then set that up so that under Live Listen, once that device is sort of left clandestinely in that room or in that place, you can hear what's going on there. So it's a basically a spying or eavesdropping technology that I don't think that Apple knew they were making available, but the users have been more than happy to figure out and make available on the web. Hey, this is what you can do with Live Listen. So last night, actually, my son came to me as I was prepping the last episode of This Week in Law. I was going, hey, Tyler, do you have any ideas for our tip of the week? Oh, yeah, this is going to work great. So he actually went and left his phone out by our pool outside. And sure enough, from more than 50 feet away, we could hear what was going on via Live Listen. So our tip of the week is Apple, first of all, before you troll anyone with a privacy billboard, make sure that your ducks are in a row, and clearly here they're not. So secondarily, if you're wondering if you're you know, if someone has left their phone in the room and they can hear what you're saying, yeah, they can. So that is something to bear in mind. Our animal selfie of the week, I think, should be next.
All right.
All right. We have a couple of animal selfie of the week stories to highlight for you this week. First is the do not do, and second is the please continue to do for as long as possible. Our first story highlights the fact that Khloe Kardashian visited Dubai recently and took some photos with herself and some wild tigers. And this is something that we just want you to be very conscious of, though we're highlighting the fun and frivolity of animal selfies. You should never think that using a wild animal in that scenario where it's been provided for your use for selfie purposes is a good idea. Now, on the other hand, when a wild animal just sort of interjects itself into your life, as happened with the famous monkey selfie case and the photographer there, and takes your camera mechanism, whatever you're doing, to capture its images, that's really more sort of what we have in mind when we highlight animal selfies on Twill. And there is a gentleman on YouTube who had a great episode of that happening. His video is called "A Dingo Stole My GoPro." This just happened in December of last year. And so in addition to being a hilarious reference to movies and incidents of time gone by, here he just happened to be on the beach and left his GoPro laying around. And actually here indeed, Victor, is where I meant to go to 111 on the video. So if you're not there yet, go there now, and we'll find what happens when this gent leaves his GoPro on the beach. Because it's happening soon. There we go. Like my dog, but it's bigger and wilder. Yes, indeed, it takes the GoPro, much like every seagull or eagle or everything else that we've featured on This Week in Law, and takes a selfie of itself in the process and leaves the poor GoPro owner delighted that they have managed to have an animal take their GoPro. So yay! final animal selfie of the week. And then for our final resources of the week, oh my gosh, we've got a bunch, because per my own inclinations and then urgings from Twitter, I would love to leave you with a bunch of podcasts and or podcast alternatives that you could listen to if you're not listening to This Week in Law, since this is our final episode. And I'm going to leave you with a bunch. So here we go. Here's a list of things to check out in case you're not already following them. There is a lawyer named Lior Lesser who does something called YouTuber Law that is very focused on social media in general. This is via listener Chris Buckner, and his videos seem quite good. He has something of a personal axe to grind. He's bringing us some personal suits about things he's not happy about. But again, see, he's a lawyer and he seems to be very interested in the kinds of issues that you might be interested in. I have mentioned before Stuart Baker's Cyber Law podcast. It is out there and available. I've been on it. He's been on our show. He's quite wonderful, and he's with the Steptoe firm, and you will not be disappointed listening to that show. Unfortunately, it seems like I'm going to mention a show that I think has pod faded, and that is Dave Levine's Hearsay Culture show. You should nevertheless check it out because the archives are there. And it's a great show. And hopefully maybe Dave will bring it back. If not, you should listen to what's there anyway. Another person to follow, keep track of, Ryan Morrison, the video game attorney. He's been a guest on our show. He has a YouTube channel, and he hasn't updated that in 2 years, unfortunately. But he does interviews with lots of folks, and you should definitely follow and keep track of Ryan Morrison. As far as podcasts to subscribe to go, Tech Freedom, which is a think tank in DC, a libertarian think tank, so bear that in mind, has a great cyber law podcast called Tech Freedom, and you should check that out. What else? There is another think tank kind of organization called Center for Strategic and International Studies that does a tech policy podcast that also definitely deserves your attention. The Tech Policy Grind, this is a favorite of mine from the Internet Law and Policy Foundry. They are, you know, sort of just getting up and running, but you definitely need to pay attention to them. They're great people, great stuff, and great issues they're paying attention to. Who else? Nilay Patel, of course, from The Verge. You can find him on The Verge Cast. That is really the best place to find his podcast. He's a lawyer. He's been on our show. He's amazing. And if you're going to pay attention to Nilay, do not neglect paying attention to Cory Doctorow over at Boing Boing. Not podcasting there regularly, as far as I know, but just read his stuff. Cash Hill at Gizmodo, as we've seen on our show today, is just incredible. Also, Stuart Baker over at the Cyber Law podcast mentioned to me that Motherboard has its own similar podcast these days. It just launched in November of 2018. It's called Cyber. And it is very much a cybersecurity kind of podcast. So you should definitely check that out too. And if you're lucky enough to be in the Bay Area and you can go to these events that are offered by Ars Technica Live, this is like the, you know, not the podcast, but the in-person, face-to-face, meet with folks. This is an amazing thing. And if I were up there all the time, I would go all the time. And they always do events, and then they record them and they put them up in their sites. So look for Ars Technica Live. So even if you're not there, you can go there after the fact and see the video. And great issues of the like covered on the Ars Technica tech policy feed. So that is, as far as I know, my great rundown of places you can continue to enjoy tech policy content when we're off the air. Stefan, any other suggestions?
I suggest people get outside, go for a run, and leave their phones behind and not bring any headphones. And then when they come back from that run, they'll be in a much better mood, and then they can pick the best stories and read those stories and be much more excited about them. So that's my suggestion.
Yep. That's a good
switch
one.
It up.
Switch it up. Matt?
I'm going to suggest following Denise's Twitter handle, because I'm sure that she has many bright and glorious things in front of her, and she'll update us, and we can find other ways to follow her and all her endeavors.
Thank you. And I will continuing following Matt's and Stefan's and Bob's Twitter handles as well along those lines. Bob Ambrogi, anything you want to leave us with?
No, nothing on this, but congratulations to you on a great run, and I look forward to following whatever you do next.
Thank you so much. I wanted to leave folks with just a couple of the quotes in my head from pop culture that I think about when I think about the show. There are a couple of things that always sort of just pop up, and one is Steve Martin, who is one of my icons and who I've loved ever since I was a little kid. And I used to lay on the ground, and when he had wonderful vinyl albums like the one that Jonathan Colton is putting forward, and I was still a little kid, I would get them out and listen to them on the living room floor in my home. And I forget if it was Let's Get Small or Wild and Crazy Guy that had this particular routine where he went, I don't need you. I could do this act alone. I often do. And it always makes me laugh because of how he managed to just completely upend the meaning of that phrase, and how what he really meant was, and what I really take that in and think about this show is how much I've always needed all of you, and how I could never have done this act alone, and how I never did. And that's where he derived the humor from, that because of course no comedian could ever say those things and actually mean them sincerely. And so thank you so much to everyone who has been involved in This Week in Law, listening to and contributing to as a guest or a co-host or an intern. My God, we've had some amazing people involved in the show. And I promised I wasn't going to cry, and I'm not. But that quote always just sort of like is near and dear to my heart because of how wrong it is. And then the other quote that I think about when I think of the show is Chani from the original Dune movies with Kyle MacLachlan, where she very intrepid sort of gaze looks at him and says, "Tell me of your home world, Uzel." And that is always what I've always thought of what we do here at This Week in Law, is so many people have come here and told us of their home world. And I'm so grateful for that. And it's what I absolutely have lived for the last 12 years, and can't thank you enough for being here and contributing to the show. So thank you for telling us of your home world, whether you've emailed in or been on the show in one form or another. And guys, I'm going to have to just, you know, defer to you to close out the show because I'm starting to lose it. Matt, take it away.
I think what you've done is contributed a great amount to the world, my life and my world. So I really appreciate it. And I know all of your listeners feel the same way.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you so much for, again, Matt is just a great example of someone who approached me as an intern and then I put him on the air, and lots of people have experienced that. And I hope you've enjoyed it. And I know I have. Stefan, what do you think?
This has been an incredible privilege and a pleasure, and thank you for including me in it. I've had a lot of fun. It's sort of, ever since I was a kid, I've loved radio, and this is the closest I've got to come to actually participating in something like it. And I've learned so much and had so much fun. And even though it's only been about 6 or 7 months, it's been just a tremendous experience for me, and I'm very grateful for it. And thank you for doing what you do. And I still can't quite get over the fact that it's 12 years, because that makes you both sort of a pioneer in this form, and someone with an incredible amount of longevity in a form that typically, you know, doesn't show much longevity. So I think that's incredible. You should be very proud. And thank you for including me in this. It's been a privilege.
Thank you. And I'm so proud and grateful to have known you, Stefan. And Bob, our wonderful final episode guest. I'm so glad that we've finally gotten you on the show. I know I got to be on your show earlier. And please continue to follow Bob on Law Next, his podcast. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much. It's been a real honor to be part of your last show and to have followed you over the years. I was thinking that I've known you longer than you've been doing this show, and this might be the longest conversation we've ever had. So, it was a lot of fun. Enjoyed it.
It's good. No, I'm glad it is. That's part of why I've loved doing the show over the years, is I could get people on the show and then they would have to stay with me until I finished up. So we're finally wrapping up the final episode of This Week in Law. And all we can say to you is, as we've experienced today, these themes continue on and on. Please, continue to pay attention to things like privacy and availability of copyrighted and other intellectually property protected works. And of course, the law and policy issues that our lawmakers grapple with all the time. Continue to keep in touch with them about those issues that matter to you, because that is how they know that they need to respond to those issues. And please continue to reach out and touch your local lawmaker and let them know that they need to not ignore these issues. They're not necessarily the most front window issues for the folks that represent us in Washington, but they're very, very important. They're day-to-day issues that affect us all. So bear that in mind and continue to let them know that you know that. And with that, we'll go ahead and sign off for This Week in Law. Thank you so much, everyone, and take care.